Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, joined today by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Let's get into the first news story of today, and that is the ongoing water crisis in Johannesburg and the numerous water crises hitting the country's metros. So large parts of Johannesburg are either with very little water or without any water at all, particularly on the western side. Even though the pumping station has had electricity restored to it, the reservoirs were so emptied and the system is so leaky that it's taking a long time to fill up. It's also emerged that there is literally only one electricity line feeding into the Eichenhof pump station in the south of Johannesburg. And when it fails, as it did the other day, a huge portion of the city, millions of people, are losing access to water for days. Now, City Power has only now announced that it has an intention to place an additional emergency backup electricity line to this pumping station, but that it's not able to do so right now because there is a large Joburg water pipeline in the way, which they are working on moving. But this suggests that situation is quite dire. I believe that a number of police stations around the city of Joburg said that they had to close as they are unsafe to be in due to the lack of water, particularly in the bathrooms. Some schools have closed down, various government facilities. I think rec centers and things have also closed in the affected areas. And while water seems to be returning to some areas, very large parts of the city are still without. So obviously not great, but this is not the only place, of course, where this is happening. We know that across rural South Africa, water shortages are a very serious problem. I was reading a story, I think, from Ground Up the other day of a woman who their taps were installed in her village about sort of 20 years ago. And then 15 years ago, the water just stopped and she hasn't had any municipal water since. In Eteguini, there's also been a serious water crisis that has hit many parts of that city. And apparently now this has led to the rise of water trucks, which are run by private operators who will go and collect water from municipal sources, collect just below the amount that you get charged for. So in other words, you can collect a significant amount without being charged. And then they will go and sell that to various houses. And this is making the municipal officials very upset, the municipality. Terence, it looks like... I wish we had water everywhere, but we really don't. And I was thinking today about the dire consequences of, let's say, Johannesburg, without much warning, did lose water to the whole city. What would be the solution?
I think it's easiest to identify the problem. That's basically, this has been coming for decades. I remember in the 1990s already it was being flagged that I think something like 20% of the city's water, I'll say that under correction, was being lost. In other words, it was leaks and things like that. It was always more sexy to put in a new standpipe or to expand or to connect than to do the hard yards of maintenance. So now we're sitting with a problem. I mean, there's parts of Johannesburg, certainly, where we're still working with infrastructure from the 1920s. In fact, you wonder why you can't get a parking space in the center of town. It wasn't designed to handle this the volumes of traffic we have. These things need to be updated, but and for that you need competent and engaged city officials. As for those rogue tankers, I see it's not legal under any circumstances. The point is, though, that when the state is not performing its duties, people will turn to whomever can satisfy them. When we had a picket up strike, a garbage collection a couple of years ago, there was a family was driving around with a truck, and for 50 rand a bag, that they take your stuff away. I think as the state becomes less able to deal with its issues, that's simply the way it's going to go. Unfortunately, a state exists because it exists, and it's not like we're going to be able to direct our resources elsewhere. At least not as things stand. But it's kind of paying twice. Now many people really do that. You pay your taxes and then you have your private medical aid or whatever, or your private security. And I think this we'll probably just join the long list of things that we are having to do, we're having to do for ourselves, unless there can be some major governance turnaround.
That's definitely the case. I think that civil society, businesses, individuals should prepare as best they can for water outages, as at the sort of current way things are running, those infrastructure projects are not going to get better for quite a while, those infrastructure pieces. And it's very important that we begin to actually think about, you know, what would it mean for a city like Johannesburg if regular water supply could not be maintained to the city? Is there an alternative for the private sector, or is it just something that's kind of too difficult to replicate and scale? We should have an idea of what to do then.
There are let's say intermediate solutions. I remember there was a company that used to advertise on the radio. I haven't heard that for a while. But what they would say is, they can establish kind of like water bank. So you would get your water normally, but they would kind of like be a system that would pick this up and store it for you, and then you could use that if there was an outage. That sort of thing, I suppose, can be done, but that's all assuming that that access is going to be restored. Water is a vastly different thing from electricity. You can't solar power your water. Things like catchments or whatever, there are technologies that can recycle or redirect grey water, so like use bath water and things like that for watering your garden, but there really is no substitute for a proper, for a proper supply of potable water, or at least a regular supply of tap water. South Africans forget how privileged that they've been to be able to drink, for the most part, water out their taps. I understand some parts of the country you do that at your peril now, but I've lived in places where you can't. In Taiwan, that's just you don't do that. You buy water from a 7-Eleven, or you can have a boiler at home, but you can always kind of take a shower because there is water in the pipes. So I think that's when that stops flowing, that puts some very serious questions over whether you can maintain a society.
No, exactly. You could do things like boreholes and stuff, but that's on quite a limited scale. I know that already I think Gift of the Givers has installed boreholes at a number of Johannesburg's hospitals. But Johannesburg does sit in a slightly precarious position in that it is one of the largest cities in the world without a major, either being by the sea or by a major river. We do have some rivers around Johannesburg, but they're very contaminated and they are not of sufficient quantity to supply the huge population we have here.
That, by the way, is why South Africa's relationship with Lesotho is so important. Often forgotten. They have a great deal of war.
Indeed. Okay, let's move on to our next story. And this is about one of the most nefarious ideas, I think, to come out of the ANC's election manifesto, and that is the idea of prescribed assets. So we used to talk a lot about this on the show. The government did try to push this scheme a few years ago. Basically, what happens is prescribed assets are, the government looks at people's pension funds and says, well, we're going to tell you where you can invest some of that, and we think you should invest it in state-owned enterprises such as Eskom or Transnet. I don't know about you, but having a pension investment in Eskom does really not seem like a great idea. Anyway, the ANC spokesperson was deputy chair of the ANC's Economic Transformation Committee, was kind of boosting the idea, saying that there was a need to revive growth and tackle one of the highest unemployment rates in the world, which means that the wealth of the country's financial sector needed to be used to to boost the economy. He said that prescribed assets would go beyond investing in government bonds and support struggling state-owned enterprises such as Eskom and Transnet. He said, quote, the prescribed assets conversation is about rebasing pension fund investments into productive assets, adding there was an assumption it's just all about Eskom and Transnet. No, it's not about that. He said, we would consult the financial sector, but we are investing in different classes of assets, so not everything is stuck in the JSE, the stock exchange. Terence, I think it's pretty obvious to almost anyone that investing money under government supervision in a project like Eskom or Transnet without very significant reforms to the management of those entities will be a little bit like pouring water into the sand.
Yeah, look, I think that once again, let me be the sort of pinko squish here and say that I don't necessarily think there's anything inherently wrong with governments being involved. If it was the Norwegian government, I wouldn't have a problem. However, until Norway decides to give us their public sector asset managers, I don't think this is going to end well. In fact, I think in those comments, it was more nefarious than saying, well, this Transnet and Eskom is saying, well, it might even be private assets. Because I suspect that's state capture 3.0. We would like to compel you to invest in this particular industrialist Ponzi scheme. There's a lot of talk in development economics about mobilizing resources, which I'm not entirely unsympathetic to. The idea is that even poorer countries often have things that they can that they can use, but I think that does spill into sometimes into writing a blank check for a government without a track record or I would say much interest in actually running something like this properly, but covering itself with a mantle of patriotism and the commonweal. Sorry for you if you have a pension.
Yes, I think as you say, there are arguments to be had against this in principle, but at the very first roadblock stop, we need to ask, is the government a credible manager here? And I think the answer is no.
Of course not.
Indeed. All right, let's move on to our last topic for today. And this is yet another troubling public statement from members of the MK party, an MK party member who is currently a councillor for a tiny party called African Democratic Change in Etegwini, and also the MK party's youth leader recorded a video this week warning the IEC that there would be trouble if MK doesn't get on the ballot. A bunch of the newer parties are struggling to get all the signatures they need to qualify for the election. In a viral video he put on social media, this guy said, "We are sending a loud and clear message. That is that the courts are sometimes captured. If they stop the MK party, there will be anarchy in this country. There will be riots like you have never seen in this country. There will be no election. No South African will go to the polls if MKP is not on the ballot. We are going to close South Africa for good. We need to close South Africa. We reject the outcomes of the IEC if it doesn't give Mkhonto Sizwe what it wants." Now, when he was asked for comment, he said that his comments were taken out of context and that he was simply warning the president that such a thing might happen. The IEC, for its part, has said that this is violating the code of electoral conduct that all parties have to agree to and is unacceptable. Terence, any thoughts?
Lots of thoughts on that. Look, I think that the suggestion that violence is going to be a response to a political impasse is a sure sign that that your democracy is, well, heading towards life support. There's a very interesting book that I've that I read a couple of months ago called How Democracies Die, and I think it was slightly alarmist, but I think some of the points it made was mostly looking at Donald Trump's rise, and it was talking about the implicit threat of violence. Reading the kind of things that Trump was saying, all I can say is if they're worried about this, they're in the wrong market. But it is something that that people with authoritarian impulses in democratic systems do, which is not to threaten directly, but to warn of the consequences of. It's enough, it's sort of a kiss on the lips with no tongue. It's enough to perhaps insulate you from a legal challenge, but it's enough to send a message. The EFF have been past masters of this, and I think that this is something that people across the board people who are Democrats, who are constitutionalists. And I think this has to go beyond saying, well, you know, they vote for this party or that party. That within the sort of inner citadels of our politics, because remember, MK, you know, is very closely bound up with the former president. There are people who really don't, who really have no democratic commitment. Who see this entirely in instrumentalist forms, and say, well, you know, if we can't get it like this, we'll shoot our way to the to office. This is a particularly difficult, hazardous situation,
and we shouldn't stand for it at all. No. In fact, if they continue to make statements like this, and I think they should face consequences, legal, possibly even exclusion from the ballot box. Because when you introduce violence into a democratic system, you attack its very heart and you rot the very interior of it. Okay, that is all the time we have for today. Please, if you are interested in making sure that you are there to vote on the 29th of May, go to pledgetovote.co.za, sign up, and you will be kept abreast of the latest developments for South Africa's election. It's very important that at a time of great crisis like this, that South Africans go out and make their voice heard. So please do consider that. We'd love to see more of that from everyone. And that's all we have for today. That's a wrap.